listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Eye of the Hurricane by Chris Whipple. I ask Wiles what she makes of the president's affinity for Russian President Vladimir Putin, who seems to have cast a spell over Trump since he first ran for president. In 2018, the leaders met in Finland, where Trump appeared to side with Putin when asked whether he believed him about Moscow's non-interference in the 2016 election. Watching it at a distance in Helsinki, she recalled, I thought there was a real sort of friendship there, or at least an admiration. But on the phone calls that we've had with Putin, it's been very mixed. Some of them have been friendly, and some of them not. Vance, Rubio, and Steve Witkoff, Trump's all-purpose special envoy, and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, an informal advisor, have been running Trump's foreign policy since the departure of National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, who was moved to UN ambassador after Signalgate. I'm not horrified by it, Wiles said of the infamous unsecured chat about U.S. attack plans against the Houthis, to which the Atlantic editor Jeffrey Goldberg was mistakenly admitted. She noted with an edge, the burden's on us to make sure that national security conversations are preserved. In this case, Jeff Goldberg did it for us. Wiles said she saw trouble brewing before Trump's infamous Oval Office scrum with Volodymyr Zelensky last February. When the president and Vance berated Ukraine's leader on worldwide television, if we had it to do over, Wiles said, I wouldn't have cameras because it was going to end that way. Wiles claims the ugly spectacle was the culmination of churlish behind-the-scenes behavior by Zelensky and his entourage. It began with Zelensky failing to show up for a meeting with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent when he visited Kyiv to make a deal on mineral rights, and escalated. It just was a bad sort of sentiment all the way around, and I wouldn't say J.D. snapped because he's too controlled for that, but I think he'd just had enough. The Trump-Putin relationship has zigged and zagged, and the walk-up to the August summit with Putin in Alaska, Trump had publicly sought a ceasefire in Ukraine. It seemed he was finally getting tough with Putin, but in fact, Trump gave up on a ceasefire before the Anchorage meeting began. Trump's team was divided on whether Putin's goal was anything less than a complete Russian takeover of Ukraine. The experts think that if he could get the rest of Donetsk, then he would be happy, Wiles told me in August. But privately, Trump wasn't buying it. He didn't believe Putin wanted peace. Donald Trump thinks he wants the whole country, Wiles told me. In October, I asked Rubio if that was true. There are offers on the table right now to basically stop this war at its current lines of contact, okay, he said, which includes substantial parts of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea, which they've controlled since 2014, and the Russians continue to turn it down. And so you do start to wonder, well, maybe what this guy wants is the entire country. In Wiles' office is a photograph of Trump and Putin standing together, signed by Trump, to Susie, you are the greatest, Donald. I ask Wiles about the remarkable 180-degree conversion of the Secretary of State and the Vice President from fierce Trump critics to high-ranking acolytes and heirs apparent. Trump has floated a Vance Rubio GOP presidential ticket in 2028. Rubio's transformation was ideological and principled, she said. Marco was not the sort of person that would violate his principles. He just won't, and so he had to get there. By contrast, she suggested, Vance had other motivations. His conversion came when he was running for the Senate, and I think his conversion was a little bit more sort of political. During another visit to the White House on November 13th, when I asked Vance about his conversion to Trump loyalist, he said, I realized that I actually liked him. I thought he was doing a lot of good things, and I thought that he was fundamentally the right person to save the country. Will Rubio challenge Vance for the top spot on the 2028 GOP presidential ticket? His answer, if J.D. Vance runs for president, he's going to be our nominee, and I'll be one of the first people to support him. Wiles is known for having an open-door policy. Trump sometimes comes in unannounced. He apparently never did in the first administration. During lunch, no one interrupted us, and Wiles checked her phone only once. She was enjoying a rare moment of downtime. They don't know what I'm doing, she said, motioning toward the Oval, and laughed out loud. After an hour, as I got up to go, I told her about how President Barack Obama's chief, Rahm Emanuel, used to complain to visitors about how thankless his job was. This is nice, he said, pointing to the wood-burning fireplace. And this is nice, gesturing toward the outdoor patio, and everything in between sucks. Wiles replied, I don't feel that way at all. To the left of the fireplace was a freestanding video monitor, a live feed of Trump's Truth Social post. The average tenure for a modern White House chief of staff is a year and a half. George W. Bush's Andrew Card holds the record at 5 years and 3 months. Wiles may yet eclipse Trump's so far longest-lasting chief, John Kelly, at 17 months. If she chose to quit, Wiles could make a fortune running the campaign of any number of would-be GOP nominees. Though Wiles says she earned around $350,000 for her role managing Trump's 2024 campaign, she was reported to have made millions more through her consulting firm. Wiles had not replied when asked about this by the time this article went to print. When reports emerged that Biden aide Mike Donilon stood to make $8 million if his boss had stayed in the race and won, Wiles said her co-campaign chair, Chris Lesovita, sent her a note that said, Boy, am I stupid. Why was I so cheap? Wiles says she'd originally planned to serve as chief for 6 months. I have not had a day I would describe as overwhelming, though there's plenty of frustration here. But you go to bed at night, you say your prayers, and you get up and do it again. I ask her about her health and the president's. Mine is good, she said. His is great. My kids are grown. I'm divorced. This is what I do if I stay 4 years. In December, when asked about Trump falling asleep in cabinet meetings, Wiles said, He's not asleep. He's got his eyes closed and his head leaned back, and, you know, he's fine. What about Trump's increasingly frequent verbal attacks on women, as when in November he snapped quiet, piggy, at a female reporter from Bloomberg? Wiles replied, He's a counterpuncher. And increasingly in our society, the punchers are women. Is Wiles really irreplaceable, as Rubio said? Not patting myself on the back, but just recognizing the reality of this president at this time, she said, I'm just not sure who else could do this. In August, I'd ask her if she felt she would outlast her Trump predecessors. As long as I still feel honored to do it, and I feel like things are going well, we're moving the country forward positively, she'd said. It's 2 steps forward, 1 step back. I get that, but it's 2 steps nobody else could make. Will the president run for a third term? I asked in November. No, she said, and then added, but he sure is having fun with it. Wiles said he knows it's driving people crazy. So that's why he talks about it, I said. Yeah, 100%. Would you say categorically no, and that the 22nd Amendment rules out a third term? I do, yeah. And I'm not a lawyer, but based on my reading of it, it's pretty unequivocal. And has he told you that in so many words? Yes. Oh, a couple of times, yeah. And then she went on. Sometimes he laments, you know, gosh, I feel like we're doing really well. I wish I could run again. And then he immediately says, not really. I will have served 2 terms, and I will have gotten done what I need to get done, and it's time to give somebody else a chance. So, you know, any given day, right? But he knows he can't run again. Months earlier, she'd mused on the future of the party and the need for it to turn Trump voters into Republican voters. Donald Trump will be an ex-president, she said, looking ahead. And I'll be gone to do whatever I do next, which hopefully will be nothing. The 2026 midterm elections may determine the fate of Trump's presidency. Vance told me that he hopes to minimize GOP losses in 2026. I think a good midterm election for an incumbent presidency would be to lose a dozen seats in Congress and two or three seats in the Senate, he said. I think it will be better than that. I asked Wiles for her prediction. We're going to win the midterms, she said crisply. Day 15, February 3, 2025. A couple weeks into his presidency, Trump found himself taking stock. How is it that you're doing this so well? He asked Wiles. Sir, Wiles replied, remember that I am the chief of staff, not the chief of you. She was paraphrasing one of James Baker's favorite maxims. But executing the president's agenda requires telling him the truth. This is especially important when the president is surrounded by acolytes reading almost entirely from the same playbook. An effective chief steers the president clear of landmines. An ineffective one, by ducking tough conversations, lets him blunder into harm's way. 4 years into Reagan's presidency, Baker, who understood the job, was replaced as White House Chief of Staff by Treasury Secretary Donald Reagan, who didn't. Soon after, an ill-fated scheme to trade arms to Iran for hostages was born. Richard Nixon overreacted to the leak of the Pentagon Papers by authorizing a special investigative unit in the White House, nicknamed the Plumbers. The result was the Watergate scandal. Bill Daley, Obama's former chief of staff, believes Trump and his team could fall victim to overreach. There's no doubt the Charlie Kirk assassination gives them an opportunity to put the left on its heels, he told me. They believe they are in an incredibly strong position to do whatever the hell they want, said Daley. And usually, that's when people make mistakes. They go too far. Day 309, November 24th, 2025. U.S. judge throws out criminal cases against James Comey and Letitia James, The Guardian. In late September, in a message to Pam, his attorney general, Trump wrote, apparently inadvertently, on Truth Social, that he'd been seeing posts online saying, same old story as last time, all talk, no action, nothing is being done. What about Comey, Adam, Shifty Schiff, Letitia? They're all guilty as hell, but nothing is going to be done. He told her, we can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and credibility. 5 days later, a federal grand jury indicted James Comey, the ex-FBI director, for making a false statement and obstructing a congressional investigation. Then, on October 9, 2025, a Virginia grand jury indicted Letitia James, the New York attorney general, on one count of bank fraud and one count of making false statements to a financial institution. Back in March, on the 56th day of Trump's presidency, I'd ask Wiles, do you ever go into Trump and say, look, this is not supposed to be a retribution tour? Yes, I do, she'd replied. We have a loose agreement that the score settling will end before the first 90 days are over. In late August, I ask Wiles, remember when you said to me months ago that Trump promised to end the revenge and retribution tour after 90 days? I don't think he's on a retribution tour, she said. A governing principle for him is, I don't want what happened to me to happen to somebody else. And so people that have done bad things need to get out of the government. In some cases, it may look like retribution, and there may be an element of that from time to time. Who would blame him? Not me. So all of this talk, I said, about accusing Letitia James of mortgage fraud, well, that might be the one retribution, Wiles replied. So you haven't called him out on that or said, hey, wait a minute? No, not on her, Wiles said. Not on her. She had $500 million of his money, Wiles laughed. The massive civil fraud penalty won by the New York Attorney General's office in a case against Trump was later thrown out by an appeals court. Do you really think that Merrick Garland went after the president, persecuted him? I'd ask her in March, referring to Biden's button-down-by-the-book attorney general. I do, she replied, and I think history will prove it to be so. In November, it was Comey's turn in the dock. So tell me why the Comey prosecution doesn't just look like the fix is in, I ask her. I mean, people could think it does look vindictive. I can't tell you why you shouldn't think that, Wiles said of Trump. I don't think he wakes up thinking about retribution, but when there's an opportunity, he will go for it. On November 24th, a federal judge dismissed the Comey and James indictments, finding that prosecutor Lindsey Halligan had been appointed unlawfully. Bondi vowed to appeal both decisions. The statute of limitations may prevent it. Still, Trump's retribution campaign continued. Leon Panetta, Bill Clinton's formidable White House chief, has never met Wiles, but observes a good chief of staff is willing to stand up and look the president in the eye and say no, Panetta told me. I'm not sure whether she's an enabler, he said, or whether she's somebody who's a disciplinarian and wants to try to make sure that he does the right thing. Wiles told me in March that she had difficult conversations with Trump every day. They're over little things, not big, she said. I hear stories from my predecessors about these seminal moments where you have to go in and tell the president what he wants to do is unconstitutional or will cost lives. I don't have that. Wiles said Trump has been clear-eyed about what he wanted to do, having not been there for 4 years and having had time to think about it, and therefore she can pick her battles. So no, I'm not an enabler. I'm also not a bitch. I try to be thoughtful about what I even engage in. I guess time will tell whether I've been effective. As the 2026 midterm elections approach, the stakes for Trump and his chief of staff couldn't be higher. Trump's second term has been more consequential than his first. He could leave office as a transformational president who sealed the southern border, passed major tax cuts, brought peace to Gaza, and recreated the GOP in his image. Or he could pursue reckless vendettas, shred Democratic guardrails, and end up in the crosshairs of Democrat-led investigations. Either way, Wiles may be the thin line between the president and disaster. As one former GOP chief put it, she may be more consequential than any of us. I think what he meant by that, I told Wiles, is that we've never had a president who governs so much by whim and who depends so much on one person, you. Oh, good Lord, Wiles said, Trump doesn't depend on anybody.
Thank you.
Angel was a centerfold. The rise of Dorothy Stratton as a Hollywood fairy tale, from her discovery behind an ice cream counter to her run as a Playboy playmate to her love affair with Peter Bogdanovich. But the reality is something much more sinister, from her rape and murder at the hands of her estranged husband to her exploitation by other men, Hugh Hefner, Bob Fosse, Bogdanovich himself. Lily Annalick rediscovers a Hollywood horror story and a forgotten star. Opening photo, picture perfect. Dorothy Stratton was still in high school when she entered the great playmate hunt. The Pinup and the Pimp. Before it was a horror story, it was a fairy tale. Once upon a time in 1978, in a podunk town, Coquitlam, on the outskirts of Vancouver, lived a young girl named Dorothy Hoogstraten. Dorothy, 17, a high school senior, was working her usual shift at a local Dairy Queen when in walked the big bad wolf, Paul Snyder, 26, in a floor-length mink, lizard skin boots, and a Star of David necklace, diamond-encrusted. He was dressed like a pimp, because he was a pimp, if an unsuccessful pimp so far. The year before, he'd moved to L.A., got himself a gold limo, a stable of girls, but the girls hadn't made him enough money. One girl, a thief, even cost him money, the reason he'd moved back to Canada. Still, he had a pimp's appraising eye, and that eye could see past Dorothy's drab uniform and Cindy Brady pigtails, her tall girl's diffidence and her sweet girl's shyness, to the bombshell smoldering underneath. Snyder didn't tell Dorothy he was a pimp, told Dorothy he was a promoter, which he also was. In L.A., he'd put on the California Truckin' and Cycle Show at the convention center. Photographer Howard Kobe met him while he was tooling around in a van designed by George Barris, creator of the Batmobile, spreading the word about the Truckin' Show. His gimmick? Staging a Farrah Fawcett look-alike contest and a bikini contest. Paul said he invented the bikini contest, recalls Kobe. It was very big in those days. An event would happen, and the promoter would advertise, "We're going to have a wet T-shirt contest, so all you babes come with T-shirts, and we're going to throw water on you. I don't have to tell you what water does to a T-shirt." Paul's shows were popular, but they didn't make money. He spent a lot of the money on himself. That was the problem. He loved cars, and he dressed to the hilt. Snyder wooed Dorothy, bought her flowers, sang to her, took her to prom. He was always trying to get her clothes off so he could have sex with her naturally, but really so he could photograph her. Playboy had announced its great playmate hunt, a contest to find a centerfold for January 1979, the 25th anniversary issue. Snyder was pushing Dorothy to enter. Dorothy's sister Louise, younger by 8 years, remembers the shock of stumbling on a stack of naked Polaroids. It was so out of character, because whenever Dorothy took a shower, either she brought her clothes into the bathroom or she came out in a robe. She was so private. If Dorothy was ambivalent about the camera was not ambivalent about Dorothy. It was gaga for her. In her test shots, she conveyed a mixture of innocence and eroticism, purity but with intimations of depravity, an arousing purity. In other words, she was Playboy's type, a virgin just waiting to be defiled. One problem, she was underage. In Vancouver, the age of majority was 19. Dorothy was 18. Snyder worked hard to persuade her mother, Nellie. Her father, Simon, had long been out of the picture, to sign a release. When he failed, he signed it for Nellie, a forgery, sent it to Playboy. Hugh Hefner, the magazine's founder and publisher, was knocked out by what he saw. On August 13, 1978, he flew Dorothy to L.A. Though Dorothy wasn't the winner of the contest, she was the runner-up, and Snyder saw to it that her star only rose from there. Next photos. In 1979, Stratton's star began to ascend when she went from Playmate of the Month to booking two movie roles. back-to-back Autumn Born and Galaxina, culminating in a Playmate of the Year title in 1980. A recollection of Louise's. We were watching the Sonny and Cher show at their place, and Paul said, "I'm Sonny and Dorothy Cher." He oversaw all aspects of her life. Even her name was subject to his tinkering. Hook Stratton soon swapped for the more marquee friendly Stratton. Everything she did had to go through Paul, says Kobe. He was just controlling her, how she dressed, controlling her every move, and her every bite. Another recollection of Louise's. It's my 12th birthday. Dorothy's at the house. We're having dinner, and there's cake. All of a sudden, a car pulls up, and before I know it, she's shoving her piece of cake in front of me. Paul had come unexpectedly. Snyder's methods were dubious. His results were not. In short succession, Dorothy landed Playmate of the Month, August 1979, a lead role in the BDSM thriller Autumn Born. She played a spoiled, rotten rich girl, spending much of the movie in her undies, handcuffed to a bed and getting spanked. In the sci-fi romp Galaxina, she played a sex doll-looking android in a skin-tight spacesuit and wedge heels. Playmate of the Year, 1980, and an invitation to The Tonight Show. She got Johnny to crack a smile. In the midst of all this, she married Snyder, reluctantly, in Vegas. "I owe it to him," she told a Playboy photo editor. "I was a nobody when he found me." Always, always, she sent what money she could to her mother. In March 1980, Dorothy, now 20, headed to New York to begin filming with Peter Bogdanovich, 40. She'd met the celebrated director at the Playboy Mansion. He was immediately struck by her refinement, her delicacy, and, of course, her beauty. The two fell in love, and he wrote her into his next picture, They All Laughed, a romantic comedy. She'd be starring alongside Audrey Hepburn, Ben Gazzara, John Ritter, and Colleen Camp. Dorothy checked into her hotel, the Wyndham, though only to keep up appearances. She was staying with Bogdanovich at his hotel, the Plaza, a do-not-disturb, on the phone. Snyder was already spiraling. He'd been working with the founders of Beefcake Dance Troupe Chippendales, but was getting squeezed out for sloppy business practices. A female mud wrestling contest he'd staged lost money. His access to the mansion was diminishing. Heffer didn't like him oozing his sleaze over the girls. Coke, he was snorting a lot of it. When he couldn't reach Dorothy, he spiraled faster. She was his ticket to ride. No way was he letting her go without a fight. As Dorothy's mother sensed, it was our mother's premonition, as if she'd had a dream, says Louise. She kept saying to my sister, protect your face. Snyder hired a private detective to spy on Dorothy, find out if she was cheating on him with Bogdanovich. A doleful irony, They All Laughed is about a trio of private detectives, one played by Ritter, made to look as much like Bogdanovich as possible, down to the horn-rimmed glasses. Ritter's character has been hired to spy on Dorothy's character by her jealous husband, who believes she's cheating on him. After the movie wrapped, Dorothy, having sent Snyder a letter asking for a separation, moved into Bogdanovich's Bel Air house. On August 13th, Dorothy visited a lawyer, and while declaring her intention to end the marriage to Snyder, declared, too, her intention to take care of Snyder financially. I'd like to remain his friend, she told the lawyer. On August 14th, sometime around 12 p.m., she stopped by Snyder's West L.A. rental, the one they used to share, with $1,100 in her purse, a good faith payment, presumably. Over the course of the afternoon, Snyder raped her, shot her in the face, raped her dead body, shot himself in the head. It had been exactly 2 years and one day since Dorothy left Canada. Like I said, a fairy tale, but a fairy tale for grown-ups, and a fairy tale at odds with itself. There's a tension between the fairy tale's tellers, of which there are a profusion, and the fairy tale's main characters. Dorothy Stratton and Paul Snyder are, in the view of the tellers, adequate to headline a children's fairy tale, inadequate to headline an adult's, as they can barely muster two dimensions, never mind three. She, the heroine, is as preternaturally beautiful as she is pathologically pure-hearted, virtue incarnate. He, the villain, is a slime ball, cum grease ball, cum corn ball, vice incarnate. They're symbols rather than people, the pin-up and the pimp. And so the instinct of the tellers is to push to the wings these cardboard cutout leads, pull to center stage the fully rounded supporting players, complicated and contradictory men who inspire the greatest dramatic and psychological interest. The All-American Pornographer. The first teller is journalist Teresa Carpenter. Carpenter's piece, Death of a Playmate, appears not quite 3 months after the rape-murder-rape-suicide in the November 5, 1980 issue of The Village Voice. The closing lines, as for Paul Snyder, his body was returned to Vancouver in permanent exile from Hollywood. His sin, his unforgivable sin, was being small-time. Too small-time for Hollywood, and too small-time for Carpenter. Snyder, in her estimation, is such a snake-eyed scumbag, low even for a lowlife, a bottom feeder with no bottom, that he almost isn't worthy of blame. Of course she does blame him, how could she not? But she also blames Hefner and Bogdanovich, because as she sees it, they are Snyder. Snyder, if Snyder were worthy. Snyder, if Snyder were big time. In the end, Dorothy Stratton was less memorable for herself than for the yearnings she evoked, Carpenter concludes. See what I mean? Carpenter is shit-canning Dorothy as the star of her own story. In Snyder, a lust for the score. In Hefner, a longing for a star. In Bogdanovich, a desire for the eternal ingenue. In short, Snyder might have been a pornographer and pimp, but so too were Hefner and Bogdanovich. Next photos, Bogdanovich and Stratton. Stratton, John Ritter, and Bogdanovich on the set of They All Laughed in 1980, just 5 months before Stratton was brutally raped and murdered in Los Angeles. That someone viewed Hefner as a pornographer shouldn't have come as a shock to him, and yet I suspect it did. Pornographers, after all, were furtive little men, guilt-ridden and bound by loneliness, and Hefner was expansive, social, forthright, a national institution, not to mention a very likable guy, and as close to middle-class respectability as a person who wore pajamas instead of clothes and regularly participated in orgies could be. Sexual emancipator was how Hefner viewed Hefner. I played some significant part in changing the social sexual values of our time, he said, and on more than one occasion. Hefner also viewed Hefner as a civil rights warrior, a defender of the First Amendment, and an unlikely feminist. I was a feminist before there was such a thing as feminism. Moreover, Hefner's pornography wasn't. Hef made pornography nice, says Mickey Garcia, Miss January 1973, and director of Playmate Promotions from 1976 to 1982. He made pornography that you could put on the coffee table. In fact, you didn't use the word pornography at Playboy. You called it art. Dorothy certainly called it art. That's how Dorothy sold it to our mother, says Louise. She told our mother that she wasn't selling her body, that she was selling her beauty, that the photos were art. Pornography, art, tomato, tomato. Only at the end of the day, tomato. Garcia, it was pornography. Soft pornography, but pornography. So Carpenter could make the pornography charge stick. What about the pimp? Yes, if indirectly. Hef had all these beautiful women, and he controlled them, says Garcia. He controlled them through the contracts he had them sign. Basically, Playboy was the old studio system. With Dorothy, she'd signed the Playmate of the Month contract and the Playmate of the Year contract. She was totally under his thumb, and not so indirectly. Again, Garcia. Playmate Model Agency was run by Valerie Cragen, and Valerie Cragen had the disposition of a pimp. People can say that's a harsh word, but that's my observation. The Playmates had no one really to fend for them but Valerie Cragen, and she did whatever Hef wanted. Nobody in Hollywood thought it was a true agency. In Hollywood, it was a joke. so to a degree was Hefner. A beggar as well, no matter that he was a king everywhere else. Hollywood turned him into a beggar. Worse, Hollywood turned him into a host. That's what he was at the mansion in Holmby Hills, the host with the most, the host with too much. The mansion was a truly weird world, says writer Richard Rhodes, then a contributing editor at Playboy. He had a giant harem going. There was an endless stream of young women, which meant an endless stream of men, some very famous. Once Dorothy took me to a party at the mansion, says Louise. James Caan was there, Robert Blake, O.J. Simpson, Jim Brown, Bill Cosby. Quite a lineup. In a few years, Caan will be accused of punching, choking, and threatening to kill a woman. Blake will be tried for murdering a woman. Simpson will be tried for murdering a woman. Brown will be charged with assaulting a woman. And Cosby will be convicted of drugging and molesting a woman. Caan will settle. Blake will be acquitted. Simpson will be acquitted. Brown's charges will be dismissed. And Cosby's conviction will be overturned. Hef really catered to celebrities. Celebrities of all sorts. Sports, intellectual, Hollywood, says Garcia. He loved them. And he provided them with booze, drugs, anything they wanted. And, of course, there were always new playmates. Hefner's professional power in Hollywood was even more limited than his social. Hollywood was a company town. And he wasn't a company man, much as he tried to be. He was in love with the idea of Hollywood, says Garcia. He was a film buff, had movie night every weekend, and he acted like a director. That's why he was directing things in the bedroom, making sex tapes of the playmates. So yes, Hef wanted to be accepted by the Hollywoodites, but he just wasn't. His forays into movie making went nowhere. He executive produced Roman Polanski's Macbeth, 1971, Arthur Hiller's The Crazy World of Julius Bruder, 1974, both bust. What's surprising, though, is that his forays into movie star making went nowhere, too. The maiden issue of Playboy, December 1953, had on its cover Marilyn Monroe and the words, "First time in any magazine, full color, the famous Marilyn Monroe nude." But Monroe was already a movie star by then. The photos were taken back in 1949 when she was a struggling contract player. Playboy, contrary to the perception of aspiring starlets, is not a natural conduit to stardom, Carpenter points out, and rightly. There was Jane Mansfield, Miss February 1955, and Stella Stevens, Miss January 1960. Only they were the rare exceptions. Carpenter then quotes a Playboy employee, "Dorothy was important because Hefner is regarded by Hollywood as an interloper. They'll come to his parties and play his games, but they won't give him respect. One of the ways he can gain legitimacy is to be a star maker." Hefner understood that Dorothy was in possession of the elusive it. "Some people have the quality," he said, "that magic she had." As Snyder used Dorothy as an open sesame to the closed world of Playboy, so Hefner planned to use Dorothy as the open sesame to the closed world of major motion pictures. Hef was looking at Dorothy thinking, "She's going to put Playboy on the map in Hollywood," says Garcia. He believed she was going to become a big star. Peter Bogdanovich was hanging around the mansion in those days. Hefner was executive producing Bogdanovich's 1979 movie, St. Jack. Hef saw Peter as the perfect person to make it happen for her. Next photos, Bob Fosse, Eric Roberts, and Carol Baker, who portrayed Stratton's mother in Star 80, and Mariel Hemingway as Stratton alongside Roberts as Snyder. The last dirty picture show. In the 1970s, a particular type of director, the auteur director, became as big a star as the movie stars he directed. These directors weren't craftsmen, how directors in previous generations thought of themselves, but artists. Weren't making entertainment, how directors in previous generations thought of their work, but art. And audiences were along for the ride. Movies were the hottest pop culture phenomenon going, hotter even than rock and roll. Among the ranks of the auteur directors, Robert Altman, Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, Hal Ashby, and Peter Bogdanovich. Bogdanovich's breakthrough came in 1971 with The Last Picture Show, an ensemble drama about growing up in a small Texas town, sensitively told and luminously shot. The lead actors, Jeff Bridges and Timothy Bottoms, were little known. The lead actress, Sybil Shepherd, was not an actress, was a model, and unknown, brand new to the screen. She'd been discovered by Polly Platt, Bogdanovich's wife and collaborator. Platt spotting her on the cover of Glamour magazine while in the grocery store checkout line. During filming, Bogdanovich would leave Platt, 31, just after she'd given birth to their second daughter, for Shepherd, 20. The Last Picture Show was a sensation commercially, one of the top 10 grossing movies of the year, as well as critically, receiving 8 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture and Best Director. Nobody in his right mind would call Bogdanovich a pornographer, except he made movies, and movies were a keyhole through which voyeurs could peep. Was The Last Picture Show a smash because of its emotional intelligence, its atmospheric nuance, or because it featured a number of young women topless? What's more, he made movies in Hollywood, and Hollywood was a place where women routinely bartered their bodies for a chance at stardom. As Monroe once said, "I spent a great deal of time on my knees." In brief, exploitation was built into the medium. Nobody in his right mind would call Bogdanovich a pimp. He was good with women, and good to women, his treatment of Platt notwithstanding. Actually, his treatment of Platt semi-withstanding. Their personal relationship ended after The Last Picture Show, but their working relationship endured. She was a production designer on his next two movies, What's Up, Doc? 1972, and Paper Moon, 1973. The Last Picture Show would win Cloris Leachman an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. Paper Moon would do the same for Tatum O'Neill. Peter was different from most men, says Colleen Camp. He wanted women to work. I was his girlfriend, and I broke up with him, and he still created a part tailor-made for me, and they all laughed. So, to repeat, nobody in his right mind would call Bogdanovich a pimp. Except, also to repeat, he made movies, was, in fact, a director of movies, and inherent in that word, director, is power, authority, control. When a director cast his female lead, wasn't he choosing a woman he believed conformed or could be coaxed into conforming to his dream? That was the dynamic between Bogdanovich and Shepherd. Pygmalion and Galatea. David Newman recalled going to visit Bogdanovich, encountering Shepherd. She came out of the bedroom, sat on Peter's lap. Peter goes, "Hi, honey," nuzzling as I sat there. She said, "I'm going off to UCLA to see..." She opened the schedule. "There's an Alan Dwan at 3 o'clock, and at 5:30, should I stay and see that Frank Borzage?" She'd go out of the room, and she'd roll her eyes and go, "He just wants me to know everything about the movies." She was being tutored to be a Peter Bogdanovich girlfriend. When Bogdanovich got together with Dorothy in early 1980, he'd hit the skids. There'd been 4 flops in a row, 2 of which starred Shepherd, who dumped him for a parts manager at a car dealership in Memphis. It was a fresh decade, though, and he was looking for a fresh start, a fresh leading lady, discovery, muse, hope. Carpenter's piece was highly influential because it was first, because it won a Pulitzer. By default, after Janet Cook's sob story about an 8-year-old black dope fiend, "Don't nobody here hardly ever smoke no herb," for the Washington Post, was revealed as bogus, and because it delivered a moral that readers already knew by heart. Hollywood is no place for virtuous young ladies. Regular people love to disapprove of the show business people they can't get enough of. Hefner's and Bogdanovich's response was identical, incredulity and horror, followed by the need to get the true version, that is, the Hefner version, and the Bogdanovich version, out there and fast. The supporting players in the fairy tale were about to become the tellers of the fairy tale. Hefner commissioned an article for the May 1981 issue of his magazine. Richard Rhodes and the editors of Playboy read the byline. "The deal was Hefner wanted to edit and contribute to the story," says Rhodes, "and I was wary of that. He would call me up at 2 a.m, so I was writing the story with him looking over my shoulder. And I had made an agreement with Arthur Kretschmer, Rhodes' editor, that if Hefner interfered sufficiently and edited the story sufficiently, they'd take my name off it. We finally compromised on by Richard Rhodes and the editors of Playboy." A few months later, in the fall of 81, Bogdanovich sold a proposal for a memoir about his time with Dorothy. "It's a story which must be told," he said to a reporter, "and I'll tell it." But Carpenter wasn't passing the microphone just yet. She'd sold the rights to Death of a Playmate to Hollywood. Perhaps not the only Dorothy-related rights sold to Hollywood. The private detective Snyder hired to tail Dorothy and Bogdanovich, Mark Goldstein, had, according to a suit filed by Bogdanovich and the Stratton estate, stolen Dorothy's diaries and other personal effects, sold them to a studio. Goldstein claimed no probable cause. The suit was dismissed. Goldstein, however, was named technical advisor on the 1981 NBC TV movie Death of a Centerfold. For the privilege of retelling her magazine piece in movie form, Carpenter was reportedly paid $130,000. As Hefner wryly noted, so much for the exploitation of Dorothy Stratton. It's showtime. The adaption would be called Star 80, a reference to the vanity plate on the Mercedes Snyder bought Dorothy with her money. According to Louise, Snyder's family harassed Dorothy's mother, insisting she give them the Mercedes, claiming it was their rightful property. Their reasoning, Snyder was still legally Dorothy's husband. Dorothy died before Snyder because he shot her first, himself second, and therefore her assets went to him, and then when he died, to them. Bob Fosse would write and direct. Fosse, a supporting player, even if he was entering the fairy tale when it was already over. Fosse, yet another complicated and contradictory man. Fosse, the final teller. Fosse was a Hollywood figure via Broadway. A dancer and choreographer by training, he'd been the domineering, too, force in American stage musicals starting in the mid-50s, his influence so pervasive as to be all but invisible. By the late 60s, he was choreographing movies, which is to say, directing movies. In 1973, the year after Bogdanovich was nominated for an Academy Award for The Last Picture Show, Fosse won an Academy Award for Cabaret. In 1973, he also won a Tony for Pippin and an Emmy for Liza with a Z. He directed two movies since 1974's Lenny and 1979's All That Jazz, earned two Best Picture nominations since as well. In terms of rank, scope, and scale, Fosse was every bit the equal of Hefner and Bogdanovich, and he had an enormous aesthetic advantage over both. Canny self-loathing was his bread and butter. You could tell his dirty secrets, but there wouldn't be much point, as he'd already told them himself. Fosse's subjects ranged, only not really. Really, he had a single subject, and that subject was an idea. Life's a cabaret, old chum, and a crummy one. That's what Lenny, a biopic of comedian Lenny Bruce, is obliquely about. That's what All That Jazz, a fictional, barely, biopic of Bob Fosse, is blatantly about. An amphetamine-addicted choreographer-director, Joe Gideon, is putting on a musical, as Fosse did with Chicago, while cutting a movie on a comedian, as Fosse did with Lenny. And propositioning any likely woman who crosses his path, as Fosse did with any likely woman who crossed his path. Fosse saw everything through the smeared lens of gutter showbiz, which is what he grew up in. He started dancing professionally as a kid, was by 13 working the vaudeville circuit, and that meant the burlesque houses. Burlesque to the 21st century ear sounds old-timey and tame. Nudity, but coy nudity, Sally Rand and her ostrich feathers. Only the places where young Fosse was doing his buck and wing weren't in the least coy. Were crude, leering, blunt, low dive, bump and grind, tits and ass toilets. He'd come of age in the late 70s rather than the early 40s. He'd have emceed a couple of Farrah Fawcett look-alike contests, hosed down a bevy of girls in T-shirts. It's a world that disgusted him, yet thrilled him too. The smell of theatrical rot got him high. He warmed to the glow of the dead twinkle in a stripper's eye. Fosse understood that for Star 80 to work required performers who grasped instinctively the tawdry, corrupt milieu in which Dorothy and Snyder moved, who knew that milieu in their bones because they'd taken it in with their mother's milk. And so, for his leads, show business babies. As Dorothy, Fosse cast Mariel Hemingway, granddaughter of Ernest Hemingway, who'd shot himself the year she was born. Ernest Hemingway was, of course, a literary figure, not a show business figure, only he was a celebrity literary figure, America's big writer, and therefore a show business figure. "You come from this sick family," Fosse said when he wanted to goad her. "It was a way to make me feel that I came from such damage," she says. "There was the fame and the greatness, but also the seedy underbelly of something I wasn't even old enough to really understand." Only Hemingway wasn't who Fosse had in mind initially. His first thought was another show business baby, Melanie Griffith, daughter of Tippi Hedren, the last of the cool Hitchcock blondes. The one Hitchcock made from scratch when he spotted her in a commercial for a diet drink, signed her to a contract, oversaw her voice, her makeup, her clothes, then announced her as the lead in The Birds, 1963. He fell under the spell of his own creation. Once that creation rebuffed him, though, love turned to hate. In the movie's climactic scene, he had trainers hurl live birds at her for days. She nearly lost an eye. And no coincidence, cast as Dorothy in Death of a Centerfold, the NBC made-for-TV movie, the one on which Mark Goldstein served as technical advisor, was Jamie Lee Curtis, daughter of an earlier cool Hitchcock blonde, Psycho's Janet Leigh. Hemingway and Griffith had something else in common. Both first came to public notice playing nymphettes. In Woody Allen's 1979 comedy Manhattan, Hemingway is Tracy, the girlfriend of Allen's character, and only 17, though a worldly 17. "You've had 3 affairs before me," Allen's character says to Tracy, marveling. "When I was your age, I was still being tucked in by my grandparents." In Manhattan's final scene, Tracy leaves Allen's character to go to London to study. The final scene in the real-life Manhattan, Allen tries to convince Hemingway, like Tracy, 17, unlike Tracy, a virgin, to do the opposite, go to Paris with him, to not study. "I knew Woody liked me," says Hemingway, "and I really hoped that I could just go to Paris with him and be his friend. But it dawned on me I'm not going to get my own room. Okay, so I don't go. My parents were practically packing my bag. I'm like, oh, come on, step it up. You're not being parents." In Arthur Penn's 1975 neo-noir Night Moves, Griffith is Delly Grasner, a 16-year-old runaway with a little girl's voice and a grown woman's body, on full display in an underwater nude scene, intent on seducing Gene Hackman, 43 and paunchy. Griffith's breakthrough would come a year after Star 80, when she played a variation on Dorothy, Holly Body, an adult actress, in Body Double, directed by a variation on Hitchcock, Brian De Palma, the self-declared true heir to Hitchcock. Food for thought. It was due in no small part to Hefner and Playboy that the daughters of the two cool Hitchcock blondes, always immaculately made up, always noli me tangere, were getting naked and violated on screen. Hefner and Playboy had changed the culture, remade it in their image, so that Janet Leigh Redux might play a brutalized centerfold. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Or you can ask your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.